Welcome to Whitley on Wine with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist Robert Whitley.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be jewelly. Either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape.
Welcome to Whitley on Wine. I'm your host, Robert Whitley, and my guest this week is winemaker Jonathan Nagy of Byron Estate Vineyard and Winery in Santa Barbara County. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
What's new at Byron?
Well,
I know you. I know you're a relatively new winemaker.
As of, I've been at Byron since 2001.
And you were the assistant, and, well, the reason I say what's new, I probably threw you a little bit of a curve there. I've seen some really interesting Pinots coming out of Byron recently, and you're really focusing on the what would be the historic vineyard there, Nielsen.
Yes. You know, the Mondavi family owned Byron in the 90s. And Ken Brown was the winemaker at that point.
Yeah.
And they really put a lot of energy and effort into replanting the vineyard, with specifically for Pinot Noir, with particular clones and rootstock that do well in Santa Maria Valley,
mm-hmm.
All the right viticulture. And I think, I know that I'm kind of standing on all that hard work that they did. And as the vines are getting older, the wines are getting more concentrated. They're getting more expressive of the area. So I think every year it's new in the sense of getting better and better as these vines are getting older and older.
You know, one of the reasons I threw the Nielsen thing out there right at the beginning is I guess I go back 25 years in terms of experiencing California wine. And if you go back 25 years, Santa Barbara County was just beginning to become known. And I was reading the profile of the winery, and it talked about Nielsen Vineyard being, the first Pinot Noir planting in the Santa Maria Valley?
It's actually the first commercial planting in Santa Barbara County.
And that surprised me because I remember the very big, very famous at one time, Tepusque Vineyard. So I was a little bit puzzled. Is Nielsen part of what used to be Tepusque? Because I know Mondavi and Kendall Jackson, Jess Jackson, bought Tepusque at one time. So I'm curious about the history of the Nielsen Vineyard, which is a very, very fine vineyard. And I just had a number of the Pinots that you've do a special reserve, and then you do a regular, and then a couple of the Chardonnays, which are very, very good as well. So I'm fascinated by this Nielsen Vineyard, and I'd like to learn more about it.
Yes. Yeah, Nielsen Vineyard was part of that original Tepusque Vineyard.
Okay, that explains it, because I always thought Tepusque was there first.
And it was. And it was actually planted by Uriel Nielsen.
Okay.
So the thought was when we make Pinots from four other vineyards within the valley,
mm-hmm.
and the thought was making a Pinot from that site, specific to that site, we came up with Nielsen as being in honor of Uriel, as well as kind of going back to that history of, that was part of that original planting.
Mm-hmm. You know, my background with Byron, in terms of when I say background, my tasting experience over the years, partly as a collector and partly as a wine columnist and evaluator of wine. I've been writing the wine column for about 18 years. I always remember the early years of Byron, which was founded by Ken Byron Brown, who was one of the early winemakers in the area. He was at Zacha Mesa, and then he started Byron. And as you mentioned, it was sold to Mondavi, and then it was sold to another company, I think the Legacy Group or something like that. And now it's owned by Jackson Family Estates, I believe.
Yeah.
But I go back to those early years of Byron, and I remember the Chardonnays more than anything. The Chardonnays, I thought, were some of the most complex, most interesting in California. And I don't think that they're any worse than worse, that's the wrong word to use. I don't think that they're any lesser than they used to be. But it seems to me the Pinot, which always got a little bit of acclaim, but I didn't quite understand it. It seems to me that the Pinot has actually caught up to the Chardonnay. And the Pinot is pretty much the star right now. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you do. And it comes down to the fact that it's difficult to grow Pinot Noir. Back in the early days, they were growing it on the wrong row direction, which would be east-west instead of north-south, and on the wrong trellising system.
Mm-hmm.
More often than not, it was California sprawl, not the vertical shoot position that we use now.
That's way too technical for me, but okay.
So I guess to kind of come around and answer your question, it took us a while to figure out how to farm Pinot Noir correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you don't plant it correctly, then you're going to have to rip out the vineyard and replant it, and that sets you back another 5 years. So.
Well, am I mistaken in thinking that a lot of those early Pinots from the Santa Maria Valley were so vintage specific because it was just difficult to figure out how to ripen the fruit in that very cool inland valley?
You are correct.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're
doing now, I'm assuming, has radically changed that because these wines have very very supple tannins. They're smooth. They're very Burgundian in terms of their mouthfeel. And when I say Burgundian, I don't mean young Burgundies because they can be pretty tannic. But I mean, when we think of a silky Pinot Noir, we think of an aged Burgundy and something that's just sort of the texture in the mouth is very silky. And the Byron Pinots now fit that model, and I didn't think they did in the beginning.
And I would agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it really has been figuring it out in the vineyard. And once that vineyard's established, then our job in the winery is trying to take those grapes and get them into the bottle with preserving what we've done in the vineyard, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I knew I was going to have you on the show, I started thinking about Byron and my memories of Byron. And I know Ken Brown a little bit. And I'm always curious why winemakers end up where they end up. I mean, you come out of UC Davis, which is where you went to school, and you could go to the Napa Valley, or you could go to Sonoma, or you could go to Mendocino, or you could go to New Mexico. I mean, you know, you could end up anywhere. And then I saw in your bio that you're actually from the Santa Maria Valley or actually from Santa Barbara County. You know, you lived in Santa Maria when you were younger. And then I thought, okay, well, all that makes sense. And then I read further in your bio and I see you studied chemistry, but you didn't really come out of college thinking you were going to be a winemaker, did you?
No, not at all. I actually had intentions of being a high school chemistry teacher.
My what funny twists and turns our lives take. Now, how did you go from that goal and that ambition to being the winemaker at one of the most famous wineries in California?
Well, coming out of school with this chemistry degree, my first job was working at Robert Mondavi in Napa Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working in their lab as a harvest help. And when the harvest ended, they no longer needed me.
Sure.
Which was convenient because that's when ski season.
So, you know, when you say you're working in the lab during harvest, you're measuring sugar levels and pH and all that kind of stuff. And it's pretty, cut and dried, right?
Pretty cut and dry. Uh-huh. A lot of wet chemistry.
Uh-huh.
And so it was perfect for a first job. And I did that 2 years because, like I said, it was convenient to go to Colorado for ski season. And then found my
I wasn't going to tell people that you were a ski bum, but yeah, that's in the bio too. Go ahead.
Well, and after that, I figured if I don't change this pattern somewhat, I could end up doing it for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Moved down with the intentions of going to Cal Poly for my teaching credentials.
Sure.
Had kind of the wine bug.
And for people who don't know, that's in San Luis Obispo, which is close to Santa Maria, where you grew up, and it's also close to the Santa Maria Valley, where you now work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And my first, or I went to Cambria to work in their tasting room, just to be around wine. And the winemaker saw my resume, saw the chemistry degree, saw that I had lab experience, and he had me in the lab before I knew it.
You got drafted.
Got drafted, unintentionally.
Yeah.
And a really good friend said, you know, might as well see where this takes you. You could always go back to school. And I found myself that I found that I really loved it.
Mm-hmm.
The more I learned about the grape and the whole process to bottle.
Had you been into wine before you went to work at the Cambria tasting room? And also, you know, did the lab work at Mondavi. Were you somebody that you would consider kind of a wine geek, maybe?
No.
No, not at all.
Absolutely not.
Wow.
Absolutely not.
That's probably a good thing.
No, it was. I was very open to the whole experience.
You didn't have preconceived notions, yeah.
Exactly. And I was not turned off by the real manual aspect of the job. As a matter of fact, I was stirring a barrel the day I decided, wow, people pay me for this. This is great.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I kind of feel the same way, pinch, you know.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, people say, you travel around the world and taste wine, you get paid for that? Yeah, yeah.
It's a rough life that somebody has to.
So anyway, go on. Go on. This is fascinating.
So, you know, at Cambria, I got promoted to their oenologist. And then, you know, just for a career path, Byron opened up for an assistant winemaker.
Mm-hmm.
I applied for that and was fortunate enough to get that job and work under Ken for 4 years, who, I agree, he's a great guy.
Well, you know, Ken has, over the course of his career, now he left Zacamesa a long time ago, but some of the people who worked under Ken at Zacamesa have gone on to do great things on their own. I mean, he must be a pretty good mentor.
He is a very good mentor, and he's a wealth of information.
And I also like the wines that he's making now under his own Ken Brown label.
Absolutely, I would agree.
Yeah, very, very good. So anyway, you were just kind of, you know, it was karma. You were in the right place at the right time, and you also had the background in the chemistry, which, you know, as unromantic as that sounds, it's essential to winemaking.
Absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. No, I've found that, you know, to explain my story, I've always been at the right place at the right time. I've been very blessed in that respect.
So when you went to Byron as the assistant winemaker, had you pretty much made up your mind at that time that this was going to be your career and that the next step would be to be the chief winemaker someplace, maybe not at Byron? I mean, you couldn't have foreseen that was going to open up.
Yep, I'd made that decision.
Uh-huh.
Like I said, as I discovered that winemaking involves a lot of dragging hoses and getting dirty and making a mess, as well as how fast it moves. It's always changing. There's always something new going on based on, you know, a new harvest. That those are things that really intrigued me.
Now, have you found that your palate has evolved over the years because you came to wine kind of late in your development?
Yeah. I think, you know, my palate development was based on going out and tasting.
And also, I would imagine, through the process, because you taste a lot out of barrels and you're tasting what we would call raw wines, did you learn a lot from the people you worked with at Cambria and also at Byron?
Absolutely. I think there's definitely a mentoring that needs to happen because you can taste the wine out of barrel and that might not be the wine that you'd want to be drinking
sure.
at that point in time, but you need to have the foresight to know, wow, this is going to be a great wine a year from now, or being familiar with some of the flaws or some of the things that could happen in barrel and what you would do as a winemaker to make sure you either get rid of it or head it off at the pass.
You know, I'm also curious. Your background, I think, is fascinating, and you're making good wines. But I'm curious how it might have been for you to be replacing someone who's sort of a legendary figure in the wine business, especially in that particular area. We're talking, you know, Santa Barbara County, Santa Maria Valley. Ken Brown was there before anybody knew anything good existed in Santa Barbara. He was part of that whole, awakening of the area as a wine area. So now, you know, you go in, you replace this fellow who's a legend. Were you at all reluctant to change any of the things that he had done, or were you kind of chomping at the bit to try some things on your own?
Well, I think, you know, each winemaker does put their personality into the wine.
Mm-hmm.
There are differences because of personality. Just, you know, you taste something and that's the time to pick, and it's based on your personal palate.
Yeah.
So I know things have changed, but philosophically, Ken and I are pretty on par.
Pretty simpatico?
Yeah.
So that's why you were stumped when I said, what's new at Byron?
Yeah. No, it is. Not the winemaking, but certainly every year the vineyard is a little bit older, and there's something new to explore and experiment with, for sure.
Yeah. Now, you make two different Pinots and two different Chardonnays out of this Nielsen vineyard. What's the difference? How do you treat them differently so that you achieve two different bottlings? Or is it simply block selection within the vineyard?
There's lot selection within the winery for the two, the Santa Maria Valley Chardonnay and Pinot. The goal is to have something that's a little more fruit-forward, a little more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of those get bottled a little bit earlier than the Nielsen. The Nielsen Chard and Pinot are sections. With the Pinot, it's either a particular block or a particular clone that is very concentrated and expressive of that site. With the Chardonnay, we're fortunate enough to have 10 acres of the original Chardonnay that was planted in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And those older vines just inherently make more concentrated, more expressive wines.
Probably more complex wines.
And also need a little more time in barrel to open up.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about the vineyard, and you're talking about the vineyard very passionately. Did it take you had the science down, you had the chemistry. Did it take you a while to figure out the viticulture, understanding the growing cycle and, you know, all that aspect of it, which wasn't part of your training?
Yeah. It did take some time. When I made the decision that I wanted to go into winemaking, you know, the vineyard is where it starts, and that's where it's pretty much made. And in the winery, we try not to screw it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a lot of time to get books, educate myself, and then the very important piece of that was mentoring under Ken. He had a wealth of knowledge about the vineyard and his 25 years experience. So I made sure to spend a lot of time with him, a lot of questions, be there when he was there, and it was picked up over the course of a couple of years.
You know, something about Byron that I remember very fondly, and it was before your time, Byron at one time, and you may not know this, made a sparkling wine.
Yes.
Yeah, but it wasn't, I don't think it was made at Byron, I think it was made at by Christian Rogano at what was then, it's Leticia now, I forget what the name of
Maison
Dutz. Yes, yeah. Maison Dutz. And it was quite good. And then they stopped making it. Any plan to go back to sparkling?
No.
Okay.
No, it's very labor-intensive.
In a word, no. Yeah, well, I think that's why Maison Dutz gave it up. It's not only labor-intensive, you know, you've got to sit on the wine for 2 or 3 years, and then, you know, you can't charge champagne prices for it. So it's not necessarily the best way to make a lot of money in the wine business.
But it was very good. I agree with you.
Yeah.
I remember that from the early days.
Yeah. So besides these Pinots from the Nielsen Vineyard and the Chardonnays from the Nielsen Vineyard, what else do you have up your sleeve at Byron there?
Well, we make Pinots from different vineyards within Santa Maria Valley.
You probably have Julius.
Julius, mm-hmm. Correct. We're part of the Artisans program there.
Now, I haven't had the Byron Julius recently, so.
It's been very fun to work with.
I need to try that. There are 7 or 8 wineries that make a Julius Pinot?
Yes.
Something like that, yeah. Who else? What other vineyards that we might be familiar with?
Bienesito Vineyard.
Uh-huh. Well, everybody knows Bienesito.
Exactly.
It's huge, and lots of people buy fruit, and they want to put Bienesito on the label because you can charge a few bucks more.
probably correct. Mm-hmm. It's a great vineyard, too. Great, very expressive of Santa Maria Valley.
Right, right. You know, we only have a couple of minutes left, but, you know, and you may not want to talk about this, but there's another region in Santa Barbara County that's gaining a lot of notoriety for its Pinot Noir, and maybe taking some of the notoriety away from Santa Maria Valley. And I'm talking about the Santa Rita Hills. Is there any kind of a rivalry there?
You know, not really. Not really.
That surprises me.
When I talk about the two different areas, you know, a lot of the winemakers and folks that planted Santa Rita Hills learned a lot from what was going on in Santa Maria Valley. And so I think there's a push and pull kind of effect between the two regions.
Yeah.
And if you put them side by side, they're two very different styles of Pinot. And I don't, you know, it's like comparing apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm. The regions, even though you would think, you know, they're so close together, you would think that they're going to be similar. Santa Rita Hills is much colder, isn't it?
A little bit colder, yes.
Yeah. I know when I'm in the Santa Rita Hills, I feel colder than when I'm in the Santa Maria Valley, I got to tell you. especially when that wind starts blowing.
And I believe there's impact, the differences in soils between the two regions.
Yeah.
Really impact the wine.
So stylistically, how do you think that affects the wine? What would be your sort of description of a Santa Maria style versus a Santa Rita Hills style?
Santa Maria wines, I would characterize them with very aromatic. There's always a very a rose petal thing going on. The fruits are dark cherry. The tannins are real silky tannins.
Mm-hmm.
The Santa Rita Hills would be more of the darker fruit, bigger, richer tannins.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, each individual site will have differences, but if, you know, cut and dry, I would say those would be the two expressions of each area.
So we only have a few seconds left. Is there anything new going on? I hate to keep going back to this new thing. Is there anything new going on at Byron that we can look forward to in the future? Any new plantings? You know, you mentioned that when Mondavi came in years ago, they made a lot of changes. So now Jackson Family Farms owns it. Are there also changes underway?
Well, I was going to say that's the biggest one. Jackson Family Farms, they're now managing the vineyard, and the investment and effort that they put into the vineyard is unlike anything that we've seen over the past couple of years. So I'm excited about these 2006, 2007, 2008 wines that are coming out because they've had all the love and tender care in the vineyard. And it, like I said, the quality is starting there. And I think in the next few years, you're going to see the quality of the wines get even better.
Wow, that's quite a statement because they're not too shabby right now.
Thank you.
You know, I wanted to taste them before I had you on the air, the ones that I had, and I enjoyed them very much, and you're to be applauded.
So, well, thank you very much.
That's all we have time for, Jonathan. I want to thank you for taking a bit of your day to be with me here at Whitley on Wine. And this is Robert Whitley for Whitley on Wine, saying until next week, ciao.